rape case to understand the intimidation factor. And then I started thinking, which of you has any experience with this? And I quickly passed over Justice Jacobs because of his chancery background. And then as I'm driving down and got near toll booth, I remember one trial that Justice Jacobs had with Mr. Kipp as co-counsel in a criminal trial. And Justice Jacobs is 0-for-1, I think, at least. You have to understand, and you when you sit as trial judges, I don't know what you do because I've never been there. I don't know that you observe the jury the way that I do in that kind of case. What I do, because of my concerns and when I'm cross-examining a child, is stand back where I can get out of the view of the jury and so that I can see the what's going on in their body language and in their responses. I point this out as a prelude because what happened in this particular case, and I'm going to assume that we can use a totality of circumstances analysis, although that's not ordinarily pointed out as the appropriate calculus in a appeal process, common sense would tell us, it's not just one particular thing, but a series of particular things that deprive this man of a trial that we can have confidence in the integrity of the verdict. And by that I mean confidence that there were not extraneous inappropriate factors, quote, emotions, close quote, quote, prejudice, close quote, that was introduced before the jury. That prejudice begins with the very onset of the trial itself in terms of the interpreter and the failure of the trial court to observe its own rules in swearing the interpreter and in determining the qualifications of the interpreter. There's nobody who can sit here who can say, I have confidence that that interpreter interpreted correctly. We don't know. I can't prove it. You can't prove a negative in this particular case. We can't call the interpreter back in and recreate everything. But that's the first chink in the armor of the integrity of the verdict and reliance upon the fact that there were not improper factors.
Does the record show whether or not this was a certified interpreter?
It does not.
Does the record show the interpreter's name?
I don't recall that. The next thing, and it happens very quickly, is the teddy bear. I don't know if there is anything that is more provocative of a protective viewpoint of a person, looking at a child with a stuffed animal.
Well, before you leave the issue of the interpreter, apparently as far back as Woolley, it talks about interpreters being sworn. And the rules of evidence, it may be 602 or 604, specifically require that interpreters be sworn. What distinguishes between error and plain error in this circumstance? How do we cross from saying, of course, the rules require the administrative directive, Woolley, all the way back to Woolley, and all the way up to the rules of evidence require that an interpreter be sworn. It was error not to swear the interpreter. Are you arguing that whenever that happens, it's of such magnitude that it's plain error, or what particular circumstances here cross us over to plain error?
Not whenever it happens. I would argue that when you look at the face of the record and it causes you pause, and I would say that when it depends on the nature of the interpreter's interpretation. If it's simply interpreting an extraneous witness collaterally in a case which is a slam dunk case, I don't think it's plain error. However, when it is a critical witness and when it is a case as weak as the thin reed of this particular case, then on its face, I suggest it raises such a question mark, such a red flag, that you have to say, we can't have confidence. Sylvia's testimony was very critical. We don't even know it's what she said.
Mr. Hurley, you were trial counsel?
I was not.
You were not?
Oh, I'd have been objecting.
The errors that are the subject of your brief are all involve failure either to request or to object. That is, they're all plain error type claims?
No. The testimony regarding the 404 activity was objected to, and the testimony regarding the foundation of 3507 was objected to. Okay. The remaining are all matters that I suggest that a trial judge should have had involvement in because of less than ideal circumstances of representation. With regard to the teddy bear, simply talking about a stuffed teddy bear and comparing that to the scene that was depicted in Check versus State indicates, and I think the language was, undisputed risk. If there is an undisputed risk of prejudice, the court must give a cautionary instruction. If a mother standing behind her child in a courtroom is an undisputed risk, a 9-year-old child holding her teddy bear up near her face, commented upon by the prosecutor, creates an undisputed risk of a going out of the heart, a sympathetic modality that has no place in a determination of a jury.
So let me be clear on this. You're saying that it was not necessarily an error to allow the child to hold the teddy bear, but if the child was going to hold the teddy bear, the court was required, without any mention from the parties, to instruct the jury not to be swayed by the fact that she's hanging on to a teddy bear. Is that?
No, I'm not making myself clear, and I apologize. I am saying it's twofold. It never should have happened. It should never happen. I cannot imagine any circumstance where a trial judge would say, I'm going to let this child hold a teddy bear in front of the jury. I just can't imagine it. It happened. It was displayed in front of the jury. The fact that the prosecutor seized upon that indicates his perception that it was something that he wanted to comment on. And for what? What does that have to do with the case? It has to do with reaching out to the heart, bringing it right out there in the beginning.
So if there was a CAC video that had a child holding a teddy bear, that should be excluded under 403?
In those circumstances, it would depend. I would say as a starting point, yes, but if it was an integral part of a process, then an instruction might suffice. But there had to be an instruction. At least you could edit it, maybe. If there was a 3507 statement that came in and you just couldn't edit it out of there, then under the circumstances, the court would have to balance out how vital is that 3507, and if it was considered under 403 to be more important to have that statement in there under those circumstances, then there would be a very firm cautionary instruction in this particular case. So I'm not saying never, never, never under any circumstance might there not be some stuffed animal that is viewed by the jury. What I'm saying, it should be done, it should be scalped out of there if at all possible, and if not, there has to be a very firm cautionary instruction. The third, and of these plain error matters that, this is not plain error. This is the 404 situation, and as is noted in Getz and as is noted in the brief, there is nothing more, and I exaggerate a lot, there is very little that is more prejudicial to a defendant in a child sex case than having the jury be made aware that this isn't the first time he's done this. As soon as one hears that, game over. That's all it's about. That's the way we view pedophiles. It's in the news, child pornography, day in, day out, as part of our modern society and the media making it known. And all you have to hear, he was convicted, registered sex offenders. I mean, it's everywhere. It's unimaginable that 12 people sitting there at 4:35 in the afternoon and hearing her say, he did it to my other niece, it's unimaginable that not one person had any kind of a wow, he's a pedophile. The trial court at that point.
Now, how do you distinguish that from a case where someone's on trial with two alleged victims?
The court seemed to be able to do it better than I do. I don't know. I have my own thoughts about that, but I distinguish it because there's instructions given. Let's put it that way. The jury's told that they're independent trials. And it is, it's a risk. I mean, it's just one of the facts of life that you have to give instructions in order to have a system of justice that runs so you're not having consecutive trials. But in this particular case, your point would be well taken if we had an instruction, because I would have to concede that if there was one person charged simultaneously with two sexual acts against two sexual persons, against two children, we have it right in front of the jury, but at least there would be an instruction there.
This information that the jury was given was as a result of an outburst that wasn't foreseen, but it took place. And I gather from your answer to my earlier question, there was an objection.
Yes.
No, mistrial, correct?
Yes. That was made. The way it happened is it was 4:40, there was an objection, and the trial judge, instead of dealing with that very critical issue at that moment, recesses for the day, thereby allowing this to seep into the consciousness, subconsciousness of the jurors who now go home, get in their cars, and the last thing they heard is, he did it to my other niece. That's the last thing they hear that day. I suggest that it is the same thing as a air traffic controller at midnight saying, well, we're closing down the airport now, it's midnight, but there's a plane out there, it hasn't landed. We'll deal with it tomorrow. And that's exactly what happened in this particular case. It was just poo-pooed type situation.
Should the trial judge have given a curative instruction over the defense counsel's objection?
Very interesting question because of this court's recent announcements about trial judges have to be more active in deciding what that should be given. In this particular case, I think that had I been there, I would have done the same thing as trial counsel said, no, it's too late, too little, and if you give it now, you're going to say, okay, well, you got your instruction. I think under these circumstances, that was a decision that could be left up to trial strategy without the court interfering. It should have been given. If it had been discussed at 4:45 in the afternoon, the defense attorney was asking for an instruction. Because it wasn't discussed, then it was appropriate for the court just to stay out of it at that point. Where the court went south was in letting it sit there overnight. And then the whole idea of a prompt curative instruction is out the window. And as is said in Banther, you don't want the instruction to call unnecessary attention to the situation, and that's exactly what would happen the next morning. Hey, you remember yesterday when you heard that he also did it to the niece? Forget that. Don't let that influence you. It's too late.
So there was no instruction either?
No. The horse is out of the barn, and it would call attention to it at that point in time. We're damned because the curative action wasn't taken. The plane crashed out in the field somewhere because the airport was shut down.
Well, let me make sure I understand you. The next morning, the court discussed its reasoning in denying the motion for a mistrial, correct?
Yes.
And at that point, the court offered to give a curative instruction, a limiting instruction, whatever.
Yes.
And defense counsel said, no, thank you. The damage has been done, and a curative instruction wouldn't suffice anyhow.
That's correct.
Okay. What we're left with then is a situation where the court was ready to do what it could in terms of an instruction to focus the jury not on what was said, but on what they have to consider and what the limitations are of what they have to consider. So nothing was said to the jury to remind them that they only can decide what they hear today and not about anything else that happened. And now we're left with, you're saying, well, you know, this has to result in a mistrial because the jury got no curative instruction and they were left with this very damaging statement. Seems like you're getting it both ways here.
I'm not getting it both ways. The trial judge, there's somebody that fell overboard and somebody's out there in the water going, help, help, throw me a rope. The trial judge walked away, came back and said to the relative, you want me to throw the rope now? And the person's floating in the water. I didn't do this. If the defense attorney at that point had said, okay, let's give an instruction, there is no way that you could draft an instruction in that particular case that would focalize on the remark that is some general thing about, now just listen to whatever, isn't going to do it. You have to make it meaningful, and you have to focus on. In the testimony yesterday at the end of the day, there was reference to the defendant having sexually abused somebody else. Oh, hello, red lights? Yeah.
So wait, then are you saying that if the trial judge had given a curative instruction on that afternoon, that might have been sufficient, but because
Absolutely.
No instruction was given at that time?
Absolutely.
And was an instruction requested at that time?
Never got a chance. Objection was made. Judge said, well, it's 4:40, let's call it a day. Period. Then arguments were made, and the judge said he had concerns. Sure, he should have had concerns. And then the next morning after he's thought it through, the judge says, well, and I still don't understand, that's why I said I just put it out there for you all to read it, you maybe can understand it. I didn't understand how the trial judge could possibly miss the prejudicial impact of the remark about he did it to my other niece or did it to my niece. I don't understand it to this moment. But in any event, at that point, 14, 12, 16 hours later, after the jury's had overnight, and it doesn't even take overnight, 1 minute out there driving home, well, let's see, what was that? Boy, that was kind of startling. What's that guy all about?
So your argument is two-pronged, I gather. and that is that there was plain error because the judge didn't give an immediate curative instruction.
Yes.
And having not done that and having recessed the trial until the next day, there was plain error in not granting a mistrial. Right.
The judge at that point should have said, you know, I've thought this over, and that was a pretty devastating remark in this kind of a case. And I don't think it's prompt instruction is what the Supreme Court requires, and 16 hours later it's just not prompt. I'm going to have to declare mistrial.
Well, is there any case law that supports your argument? I understand you're arguing based on experience as to jurors and the impact on jurors, but is there any case law that says a curative instruction might work on day one, but on day two it won't work? Given the case law that does say that a jury is presumed to follow the court's instructions whenever given, although whenever given isn't in that case law.
I'm not sure, and you know the law better than I do, I won't pretend. I'm not sure that when the maxim is given, the jury is presumed to follow the court's instructions, it's also not in the context of promptly given instruction. I think they walk hand in hand and are connected. There is no case law that calibrates like the knock and announce rule. It's just a matter of common sense. And it's not being a lawyer, it's being a human being and knowing how people's minds work. And just to me, and the question is here, does that situation create in your mind a pause? Did that jury think about this guy had done this to somebody else? And if you get to that pause, then the integrity of the proceeding has been contaminated.
Well, what about the fact that the trial judge made some effort to explain that I'm here, I'm seeing what happened and the way this came out and the way the jury reacted and so forth, and I didn't consider it that prejudicial as defense counsel obviously did, but the way it came out, it was not crystal clear what the reference was and so forth. Don't we need to rely on the trial judge's analysis of how significant this statement was?
I think you need to rely upon it as much as it makes sense to you. And I don't think he commented on the jury didn't react. I don't think there was any firsthand observation of the jury just sat there blankly. He gave his interpretation of how that could be interpreted without it being prejudicial. You saw the language. If that makes sense to you, then you can rely upon that. It doesn't make sense to me. Perhaps it's over my head.
You're into your rebuttal time. If you want to use it, you're welcome to.
Rebut. Okay. I'll use my rebuttal time. I have 3 minutes. I got 2 minutes and 2 minutes left. Okay.
Or you can save it until after Mr. Williams.
No, I would rather get it over with, as they say. Thank you. The last issue is the one that is the most troublesome. They're all troublesome. This is the one where the state now simply goes and throws a little bit on the table and lets the defense attorney do the dirty work. The case law is very, very clear that 3507 is not to be, and I use my word, abused, so that the burden of shifting who comes forward when it sponsors the out-of-court statement is shifted unfairly. It is patently unfair for a prosecutor to ask a few benign questions and leave it at that. And in this particular case, for example, part. What is a part? Well, a part is a vagina, but a part is also a buttock. We know pants were down. We know there was licking. What part of the part was licked? We don't know that. There was no effort made. In the CAC interviews, as you all see, okay, what do you call this thing? Circle it. Why can't the prosecutor, if he wants to, say, okay, you don't want to say it. You see this little girl? Circle it. And puts it right there. They don't do it because they don't have to. Because the restrictions that the court has put on touch upon is so, so slim that there's no need to. And they get the advantage of sitting back, going, okay, now you go do the dirty work. And that is what is a concern to me. I don't know what touch upon means, but I know it means in Blake what it meant is arguing the neighborhood where a crime took place. That's how they tried to get by with that. And over and over and over, the prosecutors do that because they can get away with it. And it does shift the burden unfairly. And I suggest there has to be at least a meaningful attempt to establish each of the elements. If the witness says, I don't remember, fine, that's cross-examination fodder, Burke versus State. But at least you have to make that attempt. And with the court's rulings being as lenient as they are in this respect, they never will. Last thing.
Thank you. Your time's up.
have 8 seconds here, but okay. Oh, it's going the other way.
Right.
Sorry.
Good afternoon, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. I'll try to address, I think we've hit on all five of the arguments. I'll try to address those in the order they were presented in the opening brief. There was sufficient foundation for the admission of the child complaining witness's prior out-of-court statement, and it was not an abuse of discretion for the trial court to admit that particular statement. It was an interview at the Child Advocacy Center, a recorded interview. The 9-and-a-half-year-old complaining witness, in her direct examination at the trial, did touch upon the prior statements and the events described in that recorded statement. And she confirmed that her prior statement, this interview at the Child Advocacy Center, was both voluntary and truthful. The case involved actually an assault that had occurred several years earlier when the child complaining witness was 5 years old. And she testified at trial, the child did, that my auntie's husband did something to me and I didn't like it. The defense objected initially to the foundation for the March 2009 recorded interview as being an insufficient touching on the events that were at the heart of the allegation. And during the resumed direct examination of the child said that she had talked to the interviewer, a lady named Diane Klecken, about her uncle touching, and these are her words, my private part. The description that the child gave in this particular case is certainly more detailed than the I believe it was a 7-year-old child complaining witness in Woodland who simply said that the accused had done something wrong to her and it was nasty. There was a sufficient foundation here for admission under 3507 of this prior out-of-court statement, and it was not an abuse of discretion for the trial judge to admit the statement.
Well, you say that, but you don't address specifically the argument that Mr. Hurley is made here, which is that there's enough ambiguity, arguably, in the word part, which is the child's word, that it that doesn't necessarily mean that the defendant was wrongfully touching her vagina. Could mean that he was wrongfully touching some other body part. That argument was made in the brief. It was made here, and your brief really just glosses over it.
Well, that's the fourth argument, I believe. We're talking about the sufficiency of the evidence to convict of the first-degree rape allegation, and that's a de novo review that this court has to determine whether a rational trier of fact, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, could have found the essential elements of first-degree rape beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense argued that the 9-year-old victim's testimony was extremely unclear and that there was no testimony in court as to body parts, as to what type of touching actually took place. That was the argument that was being made. What this focuses on is the statutory definition of sexual intercourse in Section 761 of Title 11. The CAC interview, the Child Advocacy Center interview that was played, that was not recorded. Excuse me, that was not transcribed. It was recorded but not transcribed. At the sidebar when this objection was made by the defense about there wasn't a sufficient testimony as to body parts, et cetera, the prosecutor was asked by the trial judge, well, what did she say when you spoke with her? And the prosecutor said, well, she said pretty much what she said on the tape-recorded interview, and this is at page B9 of the state's appendix. And what the prosecutor related is on the DVD that's played for the jury is that the defendant, quote, kissed and licked her vagina, close quote, and then, quote, and it happened more than once. So I think that's sufficient under 761.
That's really testimony by the prosecutor, isn't it?
That's the prosecutor is saying what's on the DVD, what's on the CAC interview tape.
Which is not in the record or is in the record?
Well, it's Court Exhibit 1, the DVD is, but it hasn't been transcribed, so we don't have, you know, it written out. But that's what the prosecutor says, and I think he also says that in his opening statement to the jury as well in this case. So that's what's on the DVD. The state's position is that's sufficient to establish cunnilingus, which is within the definition of sexual intercourse.
This may seem tangential, but in this case, perhaps not. It's a little troublesome that although there's a DVD, there's no transcript of it. And when it comes down to exactly what comment was made in response to exactly what worded question, it's everybody's notes and recollections and what have you, which can be less than perfect. Did anybody request a transcript? Is it standard practice not to make transcripts? I'm a little bit worried about how the record can be clearly analyzed at the time of trial, let alone on appeal, but at the time of trial without a transcript.
Well, it is difficult. It's certainly difficult for me to write a statement of facts frequently in these cases because the examination of these child complaining witnesses is usually quite abbreviated. They don't say a whole lot. And then the interviews can sometimes be very lengthy. This was a 55-minute one, but I've seen some that have been a couple of hours long. I don't know what the standard practice actually is. Sometimes I've seen transcripts, sometimes I haven't. I don't think there's any uniformity about whether they're transcribed or not, but I don't think there's any indication that the prosecutor was misrepresenting what is on the DVD.
And there's no indication that he was representing it correctly either. I mean, that's our problem.
Well, the DVD was played for the jury. The judge was present. If the prosecutor had misstated at sidebar to the court, misrepresented something to the court, or in this case, I think he also said the same thing in an opening statement, that could certainly have been drawn to anybody's attention by the trial judge. The trial judge saw the DVD, was present in the courtroom when it was played. So I think the reasonable inference here is that's what's on the DVD, is that he kissed and licked her vagina, and that's sufficient to withstand a motion for judgment of acquittal. That's a sufficient establishment of the one contested element.
I'd like to ask you about the reference to the defendant as a bad person and then the reference of the witness. So she told him that she was leaving him because he had committed a crime and was not just my daughter, but also my niece. Where's the tipping point when there is prior reference to the bad character of the defendant and prior reference to another crime where a mistrial, it becomes an abuse of discretion to not grant a mistrial?
Well, there's four factors that this court normally applies for mistrial applications, such as were made in this case. It's one's the nature and persistency of the witness's comment. The first comment was made by the child complaining witness that she said, and this was in response to the prosecutor, or really wasn't in response, I guess. That was what the defense counsel said. Was asked about her uncle, the accused, and she replied, he was a bad person. That's at B8 of the state appendix. The court overruled the defense objection and the motion to strike at that point. And on appeal, the concessions made that, well, if that was all that occurred, that's probably harmless error. It seems to be a generic sort of thing, a bad person. Doesn't particularly accuse him of anything, but the argument that's I think being urged with more vigor on appeal is that when you combine that with the later statement by the mother of the child complaining witness, she was being cross-examined by defense counsel. This is at B24 of the state's appendix. She said her sister Janet Lara, the defendant's ex-wife, had left the defendant quote, because he had committed a crime, and with not just my daughter but also my niece. Those are the two offending comments. I think the chronology's been recounted here. And then the next morning, the trial judge did offer, if defense counsel wished, to give a curative instruction. Now, the second factor in determining whether there's been abuse of discretion in not granting a mistrial is the likelihood that the jury was prejudiced or misled. And I think here you have to look at what the defense was, excuse me, that was being presented. The defense was that this was all a fabrication and that there had been other incidences of fabrication where the complaining witness's mother and the ex-wife of the accused, as well as other family members, had apparently conspired or was alleged to have conspired to accuse not only the defendant but the defendant's brother of sexual improprieties against other children. That was the defense was that was being urged here. So I think if the matter had occurred in isolation, that was not the defense being presented, it might not have been as it would not have been as striking. But here, because that's what was being argued, the jury could very well simply conclude, well, this is another example of this fabrication that the defense is saying is the root cause of all of this anyway. The third factor is the closeness of the case, and that's always a little difficult to assess, but ultimately, as the trial judge concluded in the post-trial rulings, that the jury, when they got down to it, did believe the child complaining witness. The defendant elected not to testify.
Well, wait a second. Does that mean it wasn't a close case?
No, I don't know that how you assess those. I mean, I think that's what the evidence was. The child said this is what happened. The defendant did not directly take the stand. The defendant's defense was this was a fabrication, and he presented other defense witnesses, but not the defendant himself, to assert that defense. So that's what the jury had to weigh, and I'm not sure which way the scale tips in terms of whether it's close or not close. It's hard to assess those sort of things, but that's the third factor that's normally a new.
Let me put it this way. Would you consider the court out of line to say this was a very close case? I mean, you might not want to say that, but.
No. I mean, I think that's just a subjective assessment, and that's one of the problems with this third factor is that it's very subjective. I mean, some people may think this is more important than that. And
well, subjective, I guess, at some level, but we're also talking about no physical evidence. Years have passed since the alleged conduct took place. Questions about language difficulties. The circumstances under which the conduct allegedly took place involved multiple other people in the near vicinity, which from my experience handling these appeals is not your typical situation of molestation taking place in front of or very near other people in the same room. So if you put all those things together, forget subjectivity, you've got objectively very little to support, if anything, to support simply the child's statement, right?
Well, I think that's probably true, and I think that's ultimately what it came down to for the jury. So I guess, however subjectively it's assessed, that's one of the four factors. The fourth factor is the curative or mitigating action, if any, taken by the trial judge here. In this case, I think the trial judge certainly offered to give the curative instruction and is
well,
already...
What about the fact that it wasn't until the next morning and this was kind of the last thing they heard before the end of the day before? Is it reasonable to say that there's still the possibility of a curative instruction that would be meaningful if that much time has elapsed?
Oh, I think so, because our case law is that the jury is presumed to follow the court's instructions whenever those instructions are given. Now, frequently events happen during the trial, and there may or may not be instructions given immediately about those events. But at the end, when the jury retires to deliberate, the court does give comprehensive instructions. So I don't know that the timing is necessarily fatal. And here, The trial judge did offer to give a curative instruction. The defense simply made the election not to have it, and that constitutes a waiver in this particular case.
But the defense had no opportunity to do anything about it on the day it happened, right?
Well, they made an objection. Unfortunately, as pointed out, it was at the very end of the trial day. I think it was like 4:40 p.m. or something. It was the first day of trial this happened, and it was at the end of the testimony that day. So nothing was done immediately at that point apart from the defense asserting the objection, requested a mistrial. The trial judge thought about it overnight and then made a ruling the next morning, offered to give the curative instruction. Defense counsel actually consulted with the accused and said that they would prefer not to have a curative instruction given at that particular instance.
Well, let me raise another kind of associated problem. If defense moves for a mistrial, that's obviously a pretty significant action for the court to take, and it would not be unusual for the court to say, well, I'm going to have a recess or we'll break for lunch now or something like that so that the court has an opportunity to evaluate whether that motion should be granted. So it sounds as if it might always happen that you won't get a curative instruction immediately because you've got a mistrial potentially on the table. Is that an accurate statement or not?
Well, I think there's usually some consideration about what's going on. I mean, this is the most draconian remedy you can have is the mistrial, and if there's another way to avoid it, and there isn't going to be manifest injustice, that's why these matters are entrusted to the trial judge. The trial judge is a person there who's best able to gauge the impact, harmful or not harmful, upon the jury and decide what's the best course. So I think that's why it's a matter of discretion, and sometimes curative instructions are given, sometimes they're not.
Mr. Williams, I'd like to ask you about the interpreter issue. Woolley addresses that interpreters should be sworn. The rules of evidence say interpreters should be qualified and sworn, and the administrative directive says that the interpreters should be sworn. And the trial judge says, I don't swear interpreters. What's going on in the Superior Court with regard to swearing interpreters? Is this an isolated event or what?
Well, it was news to me, and the prosecutor had actually, how this all got started was the prosecutor actually asked the trial judge if the trial judge wanted the interpreter sworn in the presence of the jury, and my understanding is that's normally what's done. I mean, the administrative directive was issued in 1996, I believe, and it's certainly error not to do it. The question in this case, however, is whether or not it's plain error. Did it reasonably affect the outcome of the trial? The burden of persuasion is upon the accused here because he's the one asserting this plain error claim, and he's not sustained that burden in showing that there's any irregularity in any translation that was given. The other part of the objection was that the trial judge apparently also omitted a specific instruction to the jury about the role of the interpreter. But this was not a case where the accused was testifying, so it wasn't an instance where he could possibly be prejudiced because he was speaking in a different language that had to be interpreted. It was just a matter of other witnesses who required interpretation. The child complaining witness was apparently bilingual, and the prosecutor indicated that while an interpreter was present during her testimony, that she really didn't require an interpreter, that she was apparently fairly fluent.
So the interpreter did not interpret for the alleged victim?
Yes. I don't know. She was present, but I don't think she said anything of any great magnitude. The prosecutor said that she didn't really require an interpreter. I'd have to look at the transcript to be sure what she may or may not have interpreted, but I think most of what she said was just straightforward English. I think she may have used a Spanish word about the body part or something like that. It seems like I recall some reference to that. The last argument's about the teddy bear. I think that's special accommodation that's permissible under the statute. The legislature recognizes that special accommodations are permitted. In Woodland, the child complaining witness there also had a bear. It's not in the opinion, but it's in the transcript that it's not unusual to see children, child complaining witnesses come up with a stuffed animal or a toy like that. And I think it's a reasonable accommodation here. And there wasn't any plain error that they can't be shown that reasonably affected the outcome of the trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement and have a short recess.
Right.